You are here for the Tricking People into Reading Again panel. So if you find yourself at the wrong one, we'll give you a minute or two to just, you know, walk out without anyone noticing. All right, cool. So I'm going to introduce the panelists who we're very proud to have here. This, by the way, is the first time in history that McSweeney's, Cracked, and The Onion are on stage together. So this is a very historical event. We're happy to have everyone here. And I'm going to quickly start from the right coming my way, and then we'll get into questions. And I'm going to save about 10 to 15 minutes at the end for any audience questions. So to my far right is Chris Monks, who's the editor, managing editor of McSweeney's Internet Tendency. He's also the author of the book, The Ultimate Game Guide to Your Life. Chris, thanks for being here. In the middle is Joe Randazzo, who's the editor of The Onion since 2006. And Joe is very actively working on the next Onion book, which is coming out in October. And then to my immediate right is Jack O'Brien, who is the editor-in-chief of Crack.com. And trivia is that Jack is the only team member who was there since the inception of Crack.com.
Old school, you guys. No way back.
So to kick things off, and I'm going to start with Jack, and let's work our way to the right. Just each panelist, just talk for a few minutes about yourself, your site, what your role is, and what you were doing 10 years ago.
All right. I'm gonna take some notes real quick. I am the editor-in-chief, like Warren said, which is like a normal editor, but I need extra validation, so we added the in-chief on the end. Our site is crack.com. It's a sort of a, we do like sort of nonfiction magazine style articles and pop culture commentary written in a humorous slant. There it is. The Economist, I think, summed it up well recently when they said that if they gave out a Pulitzer, Cracked would win every year if the Pulitzer was for well-written jokes for stoned college kids. As a former one of those, I appreciated that. And sorry, I've forgotten the last five questions that you wanted me to answer in this round.
What were you doing 10 years ago?
I was in college.
All right.
I was a stoned college kid.
All right, Joe.
Hi, I'm Joe. I'm the editor of The Onion. Explicitly not given the editor-in-chief title when I was hired, actually. But that's fair, and I don't hold any bitterness about that at all, because it more accurately reflects what I do. And I wouldn't want to be the editor-in-chief anyway. It's too much, it's a lot of, you know, business. I want to stay creative. So my job primarily is business-oriented. Now I oversee the print publication and the website publication, the videos, for the most part, the Onion News Network and all those sort of ONN-branded videos with the really high production values are mainly generated by a different staff. There's some crossover, but I only mean that to say that it's not under my purview. Primarily over the last few months, I've, as Oren was saying, shifted gears and been working mostly on this book, this big book that we've been writing for 2 years that we're going to deliver in a month and comes out in October, which will be an encyclopedia of all the world's knowledge. Only our third original book, so pretty excited for that to be done, for my life to move on from that, and I hope you buy it as well. So basically I'm involved with the overseeing most of the creative output of The Onion. We have a staff of like 14 people or so who mostly do everything. The video staff is, I think, five main writers and then maybe 10 contributing writers or something like that. And 10 years ago I was working at WBUR in Boston, which is the local NPR station on Morning Edition. So riding my bike to work, because there's no subway in Boston after 12:30 a.m., that's why it's never going to be a major world city. Riding, what's that? Yeah. What's going on with their subways? There's no subways from 12:30 to 5:30. I am. And I had to be at work at 4:30, which meant I had to ride my bike drunk in the dead of winter. So I was doing that. I was in Boston working as a news writer on Morning Edition 10 years ago.
Okay. Awesome. Chris?
Hi, I'm Chris Monks. I am the managing editor of McSweeney's. That's a title I gave myself because basically I'm the only one who oversees the website. So I just handle the website portion of McSweeney's Internet Tendency. I've been doing that for about 5 years. And I'm also sort of delving into some of McSweeney's books. We also have a book coming out this summer called the McSweeney's Books, Book of Politics and Musicals. So I edited that, so that's coming out in July. I handle the website. I pretty much read all the submissions, send out the acceptances and the rejections, and then I post it up on the website. And what I was doing 10 years ago was I had just finished. I'm a former third grade teacher, and I had just stopped working to become a stay-at-home dad with my baby, Sam. And I was starting to write then. My goal was to get in McSweeney's. So about 2 or 3 years later, I did. And now here I am.
Awesome. So, Chris, let's stay with you for a second. One of the things I like about the three of you and the three panelists are that the editorial process for each of your sites, I think, is a little bit unique and a little bit different. So, Chris, can we start with you and just kind of talk about how does content make it onto McSweeney's, and then we'll work our way to Joe and Jack.
I think it's, from what I understand, I think it's quite different. I mean, all our work is unsolicited. Everything that we publish is unsolicited. So it's just, we get about 150 to 200 submissions a week. I read them. If they make me laugh, I accept them. If they don't, I send a kind rejection and maybe sometimes explain why it didn't quite work. We are, occasionally we will get an email from an agent of somebody who is relatively famous and who might want to publish, and so occasionally we'll work with them through that. But otherwise, it's just people, just writers, various different shapes and sizes and ages, and they just submit, and I read it. And it's just me, for the most part. Actually, it's not just me. My predecessor, John Warner, handles, we have a recurring nonfiction columns that we run. And so he oversees those. And those primarily have come to the site through a column contest that we've been running the past 3 or 4 years. And those people actually get paid, too. So that's another thing about McSweeney's is we don't really pay for content except for these recurring nonfiction columns. So it's just me in my pajamas at my dining room table. I work from home, too. So that's another thing. I feel like, what am I doing here, really? Because McSweeney's, the offices are in San Francisco. I live in Boston. And I get up every morning, make my kids breakfast, take them to school, and come home and read submissions. And then I take the dog for a walk. And I have a stack of empty Diet Coke cans throughout the day. It goes along. That's all to say that I'm really honored to be here.
On the, just a quick follow-up, on the submissions that you get, how much editing of those do you do, or do you always publish them pretty close to what it looks like?
Everything is edited a little bit. I would say about maybe 80% of the stuff, I just maybe will punch up like, two or three jokes. A lot of us with McSweeney's is that it's sort of the titles are really, really important. So oftentimes, a lot of the punching up is to the titles because we sort of want... Because if our website, basically, this is actually the portal. This is to all other things McSweeney's. But if you click on the Internet Tendency, click on that. We just revamped our website recently. It's a series of links. And so the idea is to get people to click on those links. So oftentimes the title really needs to stand out and sort of explain the premise from the get-go so the readers know what to expect. So the title's kind of important. Of course, today we are off, have something called Directions to Our House, which isn't a very alluring title, but anyway, so it goes.
Depends on whose house it is, right?
Everything's edited a little bit. And oftentimes the premise is good, but the execution doesn't really match it. And so I feel the premise is strong enough, I'll work with the writer to really sort of bang out something that will fit for the site.
Joe, we know The Onion gets tons and tons of submissions every day. What do you guys do with those?
Pretty much trash them. No, we read them. We actually don't get as many as you might expect, but our policy is that we don't accept submissions. We accept no. Everything is heavily solicited, and that's, I think, just sort of born out of the way The Onion grew organically. Started as this very small newspaper out of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and it was like kind of the stepbrother newspaper designed really just to sell like pizza coupons. I actually got to meet the guy who founded it, or one of the two guys who founded it, back in 1988. I met him not in 1988. I met him 2 years ago. Chris Johnson is his name, and he went on to start Portland Mercury and whatever the one is in Santa Fe, the Santa Fe Alt Weekly. Anyone know what that is? Doesn't matter. And he said that he was just, he was very entrepreneurial. He wanted to move coupons, and he was like, well, what do people like? Jokes, so let's make it a funny paper. So it started as a really small staff, and then, nobody got paid or anything like that, and it started kind of evolving into this actual newspaper parody from what was originally just goofy headlines about farts and bat boys and stuff like that, very much more like a Weekly World News kind of thing. And then, the people who were in the core group would ask some of their friends who they thought got it to kind of come in, and then it grew that way, but remained sort of very insular, so that there's this sense of kind of family about it and familiarity, and it's sort of, it's a very specific tone that's a lot harder to execute than you might think, and it sort of grew that way as this very insular thing. We're more open about it now, but we still kind of have this mentality that if you're right for The Onion, you'll kind of make your way into our orbit somehow. And that has borne out pretty well over the past 22 years. So all of our similar to McSweeney's, it's all based on a headline. So all the writers each submit about 15 headlines a week, and then we have a group of contributors that's about 30 people who all submit 15 or 20 headlines a week, and we sort of winnow it down each week from 500 headlines to the four that are written into stories, and then an additional 10 or 12 that become news and briefs, op-eds, and one-liners. So it's very much a factory of winnowing is kind of how our process works. And it's still on a two-week editorial cycle, so from pitch to publication is 2 weeks. Fairly rigorous, two drafts and then like four rounds of editing, and then it's published. That's the sort of quick and dirty of how we do it. It sounds horrible now that I say it out loud.
And how big is the editorial team?
The writing staff is about, it's about 10 people, and then there's, four or five operations people, a graphics and art team. That's like three guys, four people right now, and then, interns, a lot of interns. That's pretty much it, though, in terms of the actual editorial staff.
Yeah. Great. All right, so that brings us to Jack and Crack.com and Crack, which I think also has a unique editorial process. Jack, do you want to talk through that?
Yeah, absolutely. There's sort of a two-pronged approach where we have a team of, in-house comedy writers, two of which are sitting right down there, Daniel O'Brien and Michael Swain. They're writing articles for us, they're writing videos for us in columns, but then we also have this other arm of input that's you know, people who aren't necessarily comedy writers who pitch ideas to us, who, you know, come from all different backgrounds. They might, one of our most successful writers is a history professor, who, you know, was pitching us articles that didn't have a single joke in them at first. And, you know, the model is sort of for those people who have really interesting ideas to kind of come through and, their articles go through the team of really talented comedy writers, and that's where we get those sort of interesting nonfiction articles that people seem to enjoy reading. And, you know, if we didn't have that extra sort of input valve of people who aren't comedy writers, you know, pitching articles to us, it would be... I think we would have run out of ideas a long, long time ago, you know, because we all sort of have somewhat similar backgrounds. We all grew up reading comedy and watching the same comedy shows and stuff. You know, we have our workshop gives us the ability to get pitches from people in Israel. We just... Not just Israel. That's just an example of a foreign country. That's we don't have an Israel-only policy. But we actually just hired a freelance editor of ours who we had only worked with, like, on the back end of the site. And I got on Skype with him. And first of all, he was, like, 24. I thought he was 35 because he was just so polished. And he's from Chile and, like, didn't speak very good conversational English. And it was the most humbling experience of my life because he, you know, is editing these, like, articles for us and just doing an incredible job. But he comes from this background where he has never had to hold an English conversation out loud with somebody before. And he does my job really well. So, but yeah, so that's sort of our editorial process. But to the point that... both Joe and Chris made, headlines are incredibly important. Unfortunately, we can't take pitches of headlines first because we don't know if there's actual information to back those headlines up. And otherwise, all our articles would be about cats because those are really popular on the internet. On the back end, we have to work with the article, and then once we have a final draft, you know, I'll send out an email with like 30 different titles that these poor bastards have to, you know, pick through and come up with the best one. But that, I mean, and that is like to the point of the panel, you know, tricking people into reading again. That is the only representation that your content has in most places on the internet. You know, if somebody's going to put your article posted on their Facebook page, it's just going to be the title of your article, and so that's just incredibly important.
That's actually a great lead into the next question. So you guys now have kind of covered who you are and what you do. The title of this panel is Tricking People into Reading Again, with the keyword there being tricking. So for each of you, and we'll start with Jack, when I turn to each of you, you've all been very successful in what you do. You've all been very successful in tricking people to read your stuff. What do you think it is about your content or your style or whatever it is that gets that many people to read and share your content?
Well, you know, like I said, the title, but I guess I don't totally agree with the idea that that the internet is full of people with the attention span of a golden retriever. You know, I think
it's like a Dalmatian.
Yeah, Dalmatian. Well, like a well-trained Dalmatian, though. But it's you know, we publish 3,000 to 5,000 word articles every day, and people read them according to our incredibly invasive spyware that we have on our site. No, but like people are sitting there and either staring blankly at the page or reading our articles, and you know. It's just not ever been my experience that people have short attention spans online. I don't know.
I mean, I think my attention span has gotten shorter.
From the internet?
Yeah.
It's changed.
I do a little bit, but I also think people know when and where they want to see their longer form stuff.
Right.
You know? And it seems to me that if it's good, like if the quality is high and there's, you know, if you treat your audience, I think, with respect, then they will want to read more because there is so much other just short form stuff out there. It doesn't really stand out. It's just a big gray blob of short stuff that doesn't really have anything to make it stick. It does seem, interestingly enough, that the theme of like a headline is something I hadn't thought about that was in common with the three of us. I mean, The Onion is all about the headline. Like, our CEO told me to my face he likes the headlines best and doesn't read the articles. So I think if anybody's getting tricked, it's probably me because... but I think people have varying degrees to which they want to read and are willing to endure. But, I mean, sometimes with The Onion, we do actually trick people. Like, people are fooled and believe that it's real news, you know, because I would say 70% of our comedic... power is just our construct of presenting ourselves as this straight, omnipotent news voice. And especially now that we've kind of really embraced social media, which is this new thing that's out there. People don't really see it in any context with our videos or with something that's retweeted on Twitter. It's especially confusing to people from Texas and elsewhere. There was recently we did a story about this how Planned Parenthood was building a $6 billion abortionplex, and when we first ran it, that some good fans, like fans who really got it, built a Yelp page to review it, and they added hundreds of comments onto it that were very much in voice and on the joke of just because the story is all about how there's a martini bar and you can like get a take a jacuzzi while you're getting your abortion and just to sort of try to play to the right wing fears of what Planned Parenthood is all about. And people are putting comments like, yeah, I loved it, it was great, my husband and I are going to come back here next year for our anniversary. But then on the other side of it, there was a congressman from, I'm trying to remember where he's from.
Louisiana
yeah. who posted it as real, you know, and he's a United States representative and thought that it was a real story about a $6 billion abortion plex where thousands of women were riding water slides and getting fetuses aborted every day. So occasionally we do actually trick people, but we don't actually try to trick people. We just try to hew as close to news voice as we possibly can. And other than that, we just, you know, similar to Chris, except we're not in our underwear and there's more than one of us. But we are in our underwear. We're not in our pajamas. Is what I meant. If it makes us laugh, you know, we'll. That's the, you know, the main barometer for whether or not we want to put it in the paper. So,
hey, and Joe, I want to stay on that just for one second, and then Chris will get to you. Take the abortion plex story as an example. That was an article, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is there any, what was the reasoning, what was the thinking behind that particular piece being text versus video? Was it cost? Was it just easier to do it as an article, or did you really think you'd get?
Well, I think it would have been disgusting as a video.
But that hasn't stopped
horrifying
any of you before, right?
Well, we don't have too much crossover between the ideas for the paper and the ideas for the video. They're generally pitched sort of under separate processes, and I think with different separate targets. But we do a lot of discerning about whether or not something, first of all, is good enough to print, and then whether or not it should just be a one-liner, which is just that headline on its own, or a news and brief, which is just, you know, three beats, or an article. And in that case, you know, we just felt there were so many different kind of details and layers to explore and try to hit on every fear that, you know, a right-wing conservative might have about this actually happening, and just try to do that for 700 words, which was a delight. in fact.
Yeah. And Chris, over to you, just in terms of the tricking part, how do you get your audience to read your stuff?
Trick probably isn't the right word, but I think that we lure people in.
Even creepier.
Creepier. Yeah. when I don't mind wearing pajamas, I wear a long trench coat. Well, when the site originated, it was started by Dave Eggers. We had a major revamp with the website, so the look has changed in the last year. But up until then, it was very, very simple. It was just text on the screen. We've never had advertising. And I think that initially, McSweeney's wanted to just sort of recreate in any way it could what regular reading was like, except online. So there'd be no distractions. We very rarely have links to outside URLs. And so we just want to sort of experience the text. So, and maybe in that way, it's a sort of some, refuge from all the busyness of some other websites. The other thing, too, is I think that we've been around for nearly 15 years, and we've established an audience. The audience sort of expects a certain kind of content from McSweeney, as much as it does from The Onion and Cracked as well. And another thing, too, is also with the social media is what we've done when we revamped the site is we've added Twitter and Facebook tags, and we've gotten a lot more traffic because of it. And what I notice is that, people are really, in a lot of ways, looking for themselves and what they read and what they like to promote and link. And I think if they see something that's funny and that connects with them, or something that might be smart and they get it, they want to sort of show it off to their friends. And in that way, we trick people into reading our stuff more, I guess.
I think that is a big part of it, actually, the sort of being in on it.
Yep.
Because people who might not read The Onion normally but are still aware of it, every couple of months there'll be a headline that makes it across their desk, and they really love it, and then they want to share it with everybody else because it does sort of, that's really interesting, speak to something particular about you and that you want people to know that you and get.
And it's hard to talk about that without making these people sound like they're shallow. But when you find something that's funny, you want to boast about it, and you want to sort of, I think this is funny. So in a way, this is sort of like me. Sharing my sense of humor. I'm sharing pictures of my cats, and I'm also sharing my sense of humor on Facebook. There's a lot of that.
And then, Chris, just a follow-up for you. So all three of you have had success publishing offline as well. You've talked about the book.
Successful offline.
You guys have talked about books offline, and you've worked on. You have your book that you've published, right?
Right. Success isn't a word to use for the book.
It's all in the mind of the writer, right? What has been your experience in general? Just taking what we've talked about, the respective sites. How have you drawn from your offline writing experience, or what do you notice are the differences between publishing something offline versus publishing something online?
I think the differences are becoming less and less as we move on. McSweeney's, the print McSweeney's is very different from the web McSweeney's, and that separation is growing more and more. And that's a good thing, I think. We're having a book coming out with a lot of this stuff, features stuff that's been on our website. And there's also new stuff, too. I see it's sort of
similar.
Yeah.
I mean, you guys put, you guys do, haikus and stuff on your website. So I feel like your articles online are sort of have these constraints, which is part of the format and part of what makes them really funny. Our experience was actually that going from online to print, when we published a book that was sort of an anthology of some of our best articles and some new articles last year, was that they actually made us condense everything, and everything had to be shorter offline.
because it costs money to print words on paper and not on the internet. The internet is cheap. But yeah, so I guess that's just another part of the internet allowing you to just have a little bit more freedom than you would in print formats, and also sort of lowering the barrier of entry.
Yeah, we're like the most uncensored publication ever, pretty much. Like, we can do whatever we want, really, for the satire laws, and we don't have a big company that oversees us. We're independently owned. The only thing is we can't put the F word on the front page of the newspaper because it gets delivered by the U.S. mail. That's the only restriction that we have. But we did do a book a few years ago, which was a compilation, sort of this big reprint of our best front pages called Our Front Pages. And it was printed in China, which this current book will not be. But it was printed in China, and they did censor two things in it, which really felt like invasive and weird to have the publisher send it back and say, like, the government won't allow us to send this out of the country, so we won't even print it. But it was just a reference to, there was just a map. Actually, the joke was completely unrelated. It was Snackistan improves relations with Frito-Laysia, I think it was. Snackistan reestablishes diplomatic relations with Frito-Laysia. So it's the stupidest joke that you could imagine the Chinese government getting upset about, but on the little map that we made, we just put North Korea and South Korea, and they said that was unacceptable because it needs to be the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. It can't be North Korea. Wow. And then there was another one where we mentioned the Dalai Lama, so they were like, nah, you can't mention him. But we, like, cracked like McSweeney's, too. We started as a print, organization, so it was more about a transition to digital for us, which we did very, very slowly and very dumbly. We went online in 1996, and we would just, on Wednesday, hit publish and just publish everything. And that was it. And that was all that we did once a week with no marketing or anything. It was just, there's the newspaper online, because nobody knew what it was. People were scared of it. So there hasn't been, I think each time we do an original book, we have to reinvent our process a little bit because we're not doing news articles. But other than that, there's not much.
And your new book, is that original content?
Yes, that's all original.
It's all
yeah.
Original. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's interesting. You mentioned, and how recently was it for the NN that you were just publishing once a week?
Till September 11th, and then everything changed after that.
That being the biggest way that things changed was.
It was actually around that time that we went to 5 days a week.
We might have broken the too soon barrier.
I don't think so.
Didn't expect on this panel.
Glad one person laughed at that. That's good. I think it was around 2000 or so. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so that kind of it leads me to my next question. I'll start with Jack, because I think you can look back at Cracked in 2006, 2007, and the publishing schedule was different, and the content, everything about it has been tweaked since then. What do you see changing, in either specifically for Cracked or in general, in publishing over the next couple of years?
So definitely social media has changed things. It's changed the way people find our content. But I think it's made it easier for people to do stuff that they were already doing. Like, I don't know, I'm always interested in hearing if this is true for other sites, but we always used to see that the Monday after Thanksgiving, when, like, everybody would go home to their high school and get drunk with their high school friends from college, we would always see the day that they came back to school would be, like, a huge spike for us. Like every year as we grew and grew, like that would be like a big growth date for us. And I think it was just a case of people doing what they're doing on their Facebook pages, telling their friends about this cool thing that they found in college, about Cracked, and then
after that, just things kind of growing. So, I mean, I don't know what, I didn't attend enough panels at South by Southwest to know what the next social media innovation is going to be. I'm sure maybe some of the people who ask us questions at the end can tell us. You know, just more bringing online sort of content finding methods that, you know, are just basically digital versions of what people are already doing and how people are already sharing content. But we've, in terms of specifically what Cracked is doing, you know, we've gotten up to 4 pieces of content a day now. And we've just, for whatever reason, naturally gone long on our content. So we have these 4 massive pieces of content a day that I don't read them all, I think our next move is going to be to go short and timely and topical with our publishing schedule, in addition to the 4 pieces of content that we're doing a day. Moving, kind of translating our article voice to video. You know, we have a series that does that pretty well already called After Hours. That's up today. Go check it out. We're trying a bunch of different things to do that. You know, some motion comics where we'll be able to sort of explain really interesting pieces of information by just kind of diagramming them in motion. So those are a few of the things that you can expect this year, as well as we have a book too, but it's not as pressing a deadline as these guys. So.
And Chris with McSweeney's, what about you guys in the upcoming years? Do you think you're going to stick to the model that's been working so far, or tweak it a bit, expand?
Well, the other McSweeney's avenues, I'm sure there'll be dozens of other things between now and the next 5 years. But in terms of the website, I mean, the website was the same for 12 years, and then we just changed it last summer. And I think it'll be at least another 12 years before the website changes. I think we pretty much stick with what we're doing. I mean, the website basically is a window to bring people to check out the other parts of McSweeney's. And it's working, what we're doing now. So you won't see any video, you won't see any advertising. It's probably going to stay the same.
Mm-hmm. And Joe?
I don't want to, that's not going to be boring and sort of sit back. I mean, our content will continue to be topical, but in terms of what it looks like now, I'd be shocked if it looked any different 5 years from now.
Okay. And Joe, what about The Onion?
Got some ice there. Didn't see that coming. I mean, I think, you know, topical is sort of the word. It's, you know, we're sort of looking to have more active news direction. The way we've done things, historically the way we've done things is we wanted to really separate ourselves from sort of the nightly monologue of Jay Leno or Jon Stewart and, you know, do something totally different, because we were just much more based in the newspaper, you know, sort of thoughtful, methodical analysis of the whole picture. And we would really keep that, maintain that for as long as we possibly could, of, you know, not commenting on the event itself, but waiting to weigh in and commenting on all the commentary. And so we were very gun-shy about jumping in at all into Twitter, although it's a perfect, I mean, our headlines just fit perfectly right into a tweet.
Yeah, I have a conspiracy theory that you guys actually developed Twitter as a delivery method for Onion content.
I wish to God that were true.
You would not be on this panel right now with us.
No. No. Where was I going? Oh, right. So, but then we found that, you know, we could respond very quickly to things with just a one-liner and then still take a day or two to come up with a joke that's a little more in depth that might stand the test of time a little more. But, you know, it's undeniable that when we do things that are on topic, like when Trump was calling for Obama's birth certificate, we ran a little headline that was something like Donald Trump unable to provide documents proving that he's not a festering pile of human garbage or human excrement or something like that. And it got 700,000 likes on Facebook in like 48 hours or something. I mean, it was by far the most wildly successful thing that we'd ever done. And so that it's, I think it took our staff a while to figure out, first of all, that we could do it, and then how to do it. And now, you know, we're still going to maintain the long-form content that you love, but trying to work in a little bit more of that stuff, because it is also really fun for us to be able to do that now that we've sort of gotten our Twitter legs, as it were.
You write a tweet headline without any story behind it.
And we do that sometimes, yeah.
And if it's a success, then you go back and you write an article based on that tweet?
No, we'll write a different article.
Yeah.
You know, we'll come up with a headline that's a little more of a just immediate response, and then, you know, we'll write something a little more in-depth over the next day or two. And another thing that we've done, trying to really build this news program to fully emulate the way news breaks over the course of a day, is to start a big story with just some breaking headlines on Twitter that are just headlines, which we did recently with this story about Congress taking a bunch of children hostage for an $8 trillion ransom or something like that.
Didn't that get you in trouble?
Yeah, well, the first thing we tweeted didn't have a joke. It was just report shots fired in the U.S. Capitol building. So that's not a joke. So I can understand in retrospect why people might have thought it wasn't a joke. So that was supposed to sort of be like to trick people into like what's going on here. And then over the course of the day, we provided sort of more and then broke with the big story and then had analysis over the course of the day. But we actually had... I guess the Capitol Police had to close down the Capitol and look for a gunman, which didn't exist. But we didn't get in any trouble for that, which is nice. But it did cause quite a stir. And again, it was because people saw it without any context. It was retweeted several thousand times within the first 5 minutes. So people who, even if they knew what The Onion was, didn't see that it was necessarily from The Onion.
Yeah. Right, so for the people in the audience, or the tens of folks who are watching the live feed of this, who are, I don't even know if there's a live feed, the people just listening outside the door who don't have passes but want to hear all this wisdom.
Al Gore is out there. Right?
Al Gore is out there somewhere.
He's dropping. Couldn't get in.
But for those who are aspiring writers or who have blogs or who want to write more online, what advice – it would be a two-part question. But the first is, what are there any trends that you see – without giving away your trade secrets, all three of you, but there's got to be some trends you see when you're crafting your article or crafting your written piece where you just have a gut feel that this one's going to do better than others. I really feel good about this.
Cats. No,
I really feel good because X. For all you guys, what is that thing that you feel makes content successful? If there is a trend that you can point to, we'll start with Jack.
I don't know that. I mean, there are certain subjects certainly that people are irrationally interested in, such as like I'm a dog person. I don't find cats interesting particularly. And we wrote this article that did way better than I expected about cats, scientific reason cats are evil. So I figured, okay, well, now we'll write the dog equivalent of that because dogs are just as interesting as cats, and we posted it, and it was crickets. So there definitely is something to the whole cat thing. But I guess my advice to aspiring writers is always just to, there's no real reason to be aspiring anymore with the internet. Like the most famous fashion blogger, because I'm a fashionista, as you can tell, but is like a 12-year-old girl who just like posts on a blogger account, I think. I guess to use a less completely random example, our senior editor is a guy named David Wong who started writing just like a story in our forums about 5 years ago just to like make people who love him there laugh. And he would update every couple months, and eventually it got to novel length, and he self-published it. St. Martin's came to him and said, well, like, lots of people wanted to buy that, and that became a huge novel, and the movie version of that is premiering tonight at midnight at South by Southwest. And there's a story in this Wired, this past Wired, about a guy who got a movie writing deal off of comments he wrote in Reddit. If you have something interesting to say and you want to write, then you should write. There's an appetite for content out there, I think, and the internet is huge.
Joe. Yeah, you really backed your way out of that cat thing that was your first piece of advice. I agree with all of that, except for the cats. I find cats disgusting. Really do. I think you don't like. I know you don't. I know. I think you just need to be willing to sort of suck, and for it to suck for a while, and for people to think that you suck. And while I think it's really important that you have your own voice and not necessarily emulate what others do, I think like any chance you can get to write, you should. If you're paid to write for something that you don't want to do, I guarantee when you're done with it, you're going to have something that you've learned and something that you've gotten better at. If nothing else, then just like putting it under your belt. A lot of people seem to think they, you know, if they do get lucky enough to sort of get a chance at contributing to The Onion, they don't really have a very thick skin, and the first list that they submit gets torn apart, which is just what happens to writers who've been writing for 5 years if they don't have a good joke, and then they just give up, you know? And it's like, but we've been perfecting this over 20 years. You should give yourself a break. Like, you're not going to get it right the first time. And The Onion's obviously a very specific example of this, but while I think you need to be willing to work really hard, I think you also just shouldn't take it too seriously, because you're going to find your way into something that you like. And if you want to be a fake news writer, I don't even recommend writing fake news. I think people have found their way to The Onion through other avenues just by being funny. You can sort of train somebody to write in the news voice, but what we definitely respond more to is somebody who's a little bit bold and unique and weird, and not afraid to just sort of do what they think is funny, not what they think we will think is funny, because that actually falls flat pretty much every single time. So that's a little bit Onion specific, but I think it's good advice too. I haven't followed any of it, but I would say I think that's basically what I would say.
Chris?
I would agree with these guys, and also it's like the most simple answer is just to write. I mean, that's what I did. I just wrote and wrote. I had a blog and I wrote every day on it, and I got ideas for things that I would pitch to other places like Cracked. Cracked featured my stuff early on too, from writing that I was doing on my blog. That's not to say I think you should start a blog, because I think there's so many blogs, too many blogs at the moment. But I think just sort of discovering your voice, and then really doing lots of research on places that you feel like your voice would be a good fit for. A lot of people are really, they mean well when they submit to McSweeney's, but it's clear that they haven't really read the website. And, we publish silly literary pop culture humor, and occasionally we'll get like this, long 5,000 word short story about cats. Know your audience. Know who your audience wants to be. Find places that cater to that audience. And if your voice fits within those spaces, then just keep pushing. I was rejected 15, 16 times before I landed a piece at McSweeney's. Perseverance is key, too.
And just going on with what some of you guys, I think, briefly touched on, but you might not start with a, like, crazy original voice, and that's something, like, when I first started writing, I wrote exactly like Dave Eggers, because that's who made me want to write. You know, I read his, the heartbreaking, staggering genius book, and, you know, I just thought that was amazing, and, you know, you start writing, and, you know, don't be afraid to write a little bit like the people who inspire you, and, like, as long as you write, your voice will come to you.
Cool. Thanks, guys. I think we have about 10 minutes left, so we will take questions from the audience. And I imagine, since there's a mic there that hasn't been used yet, that it's feeling lonely. So I guess you can step right up there and don't be shy. And when you do, just say your name and who you work for, what you do, and then ask your question.
And Joe has volunteered to rap battle anybody who wants to bring it.
Okay. Hi. My name is Max. I'm from Orlando, Florida. I work for Allogy Incorporated. We create mobile applications for education and healthcare. I'll preface this by saying that this conference has been of particular significance to me because this is the first time that I've encountered The Onion in newspaper form. I've been reading you guys every day, like, for many, many, many years. I've got your books, but I've never actually seen your newspaper in newspaper form until the hotel.
Oh, cool.
So that was a real treat. But take a look at that. If you take a look at the crack.com site, you looked at four out of six articles that are displayed there have lists as headlines. How did you guys end up?
I did not notice that. That is crazy.
It seriously seems to me that, like, you know, 60 to 80% of what you do is lists. How did you end up with that?
So that was a lot of guess and check, and sort of for the first couple years that we had a website. We ran all sorts of different types of content, and I got tired of all our best writers writing these sort of high concept things that nobody would read, and then you know, our lazy writers writing lists. So we decided to challenge our best writers to write lists that, you know, just kind of pour our nonfiction articles into this format that people clearly like to read and that clearly works online. And, you know, there's nothing about a list that says it has to be short form. As I mean, the lists are the same articles I was talking about that are 3,000 to 5,000 words long. I just wrote an article about how Tom Hanks pees in all his movies that is 4,000 words long. And I think actually the list format allows you to do that because it organizes things for you. So the reader can, if he already knows Tom Hanks pees in all his movies, he can skip past that part and look at the part about how Tom Cruise runs in all his movies. So that's...
All right, cool. Thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hello, Ben Popkin, former managing editor of consumerist.com. But all of you guys are really good at tricking people into reading comedy. And my question is, do you have any kind of case studies or just favorite articles from the past where you are proud of how you had used comedy to get people to read about an important issue or something that might not otherwise have been digestible, you know, if you hadn't put the pill in the ice cream?
Well, McSweeney's run several nonfiction columns, basically like personal essays. And the hook is the website, but people click on it, and I mean, a lot of these columns have humor, but they're about bigger things. Like, there's one right now about a Christian missionary living in Portland that has gotten a lot of great feedback. There's another about this comedian who actually found comedy after her son died, and it's this incredible story how she sort of hooked up with her rabbi, who off on the side did improv comedy, and so it became this really sort of very touching, it's become this touching series of essays about sort of her coming to terms with her child's death, but also sort of finding comedy and how that sort of helped her lift her. So don't mean to get too heavy, but so I think, you know, we're not all hot, funny, ha-ha, and there is some stuff there. So we like to mix it up a little bit. And so, yeah, so we bring the, we lure people in with the humor, but there's other stuff there that you delve deeper into the site.
We don't usually do too much kind of, what do you call it, activist stuff. There's just a couple occasions that come to mind. After the Haiti earthquake, Rush Limbaugh said some very hateful things, so I sort of demanded that that we write an op-ed where, you know, Rush Limbaugh says, I don't even want to be alive anymore, and he's basically calling for his own death. And then, you know, we also have one of our writers who's a frequent flyer, and he learned about this big problem where people will shoot laser pointers at airplanes, and apparently the refraction of the cockpit window is such that it, like, blinds the pilot and they can't fly the plane. And you know that this is a big problem, apparently.
Yeah, it's the, like, the green industrial grade lasers that are for, like, the military to point up into the sky and do sky Jesus. Pointing. If you shoot, well, I guess we shouldn't really. Well, we cat's out of the bag, but
yeah, go try it because it'll so crash a whole plane,
and the cops will find you and triangulate you.
These people look responsible.
But we did an op-ed that was like from the perspective of a pilot who was like, "Yeah, we're going to be, you know, we're taking off, and oh, someone's shining a laser at me, and we're going down." And it's the only time I could think of where we were like, "People need to know about this,"
right.
And we wrote an op-ed. To that,
you know, articles, they start off, they're funny, but they often are really important commentaries on what actually is going on in the world. And so people use them as a reference, but then it comes into like a serious discussion about like what you're sort of mocking.
Yeah, it's the only way I get my news is through your website.
It's pathetic.
Yeah, really bad. I have no idea what's going on in the world.
I think we're like driven by how funny something is and just how interesting we find the information that the article would contain. And I think that we don't do a lot of topical stuff about Rush Limbaugh trying to bring planes down, which happened. I think our site, the nonfiction content on our site, makes the world seem more interesting than you thought it was before you read the article, and that's something that I guess I'm proud of, is if anybody was, you know, raised in public education system and thought that the world was, you know, that science or history had to be boring, I think our articles do a pretty good job of disproving that.
Cool. Thanks.
Hi, Eli. I'm a back-end programmer for OkCupid. And came to this this panel seeing the title, Tricking People Into Reading Again. And I guess this question, at first, probably more for Jack O'Brien. I know that Cracked is owned by Demand Media. And one of the things that I've read about Demand Media is that they spend a lot of time, well, appropriately analyzing demand for pieces of content and then trying to deliver on that demand in a really calculated way. I wondered to what extent you guys think that part of tricking people into reading again, or, you know, goading them, luring them, whatever, is wrought out of like an empirical study of observations about what people want to read, and like how do you guys try to figure that out?
Yeah.
I wondered if like, you don't need to get into details about it, but if Demand Media has like a platform for doing this, and if they've tried to like integrate you into that, or if it's all just like, you know, shoot from the hip.
Yeah, like I said, we have really invasive spyware that tells us what you guys are reading, where your eyes are.
It's hard to get a tinfoil hat over all of this, but right.
No, we are not part of the thing that you're referring to. Doesn't inform any of our editorial decisions. We have 2 3-hour calls every week where we discuss each idea that gets pitched to us, and then we just go with how much we want to read that article and what we can change to make us want to read that article. It's a pretty simple process.
We don't have any stuff for figuring out what readers want. The only time in my entire memory of working at The Onion that there's even been any sort of outside demand? I mean, obviously we're working more and more with advertisers, so there's definitely stuff that we wouldn't have done 5 years ago that we're doing today. But you know, at one point, some of our business staff and sales staff sort of recognized that entertainment, the category of entertainment and the category of sports, are extremely popular on our site and seem to be popular in the world, and we need to sell videos. So there was sort of a suggestion that we come up with some videos about entertainment and about sports. But beyond that, we don't really have too many metrics. That's probably why Cracked does a lot better than us, gets a lot more feed views.
Spyware,
too.
That makes me think when it's just me.
Make Chris laughs.
No,
laugh
in here.
But, and Eli, just to follow up on your question specifically to demand, so the difference that Jack was pointing to is with demand media, there's algorithmically based stuff that can determine, for example, that how to tie a tie is a very popular search term. So there should be content to go against that particular search. The difference with Cracked is Cracked doesn't look at that data and say, hey, we've got to do comedy on how to tie a tie because it's hilarious, and we've got to rank up there because if people are searching for it, they want to laugh about it. The comedy aspect to demand is a completely separate editorial process.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Hi, Max again. Do any of you guys make attempts to either like explicitly broaden your reader base or to placate demographics you may have pissed off? I'm speaking this like on my Facebook feed. I sometimes see some very very conservative friends of mine post stuff from The Onion, but you also run stuff like, you know, Santorum slowly coming to, you know, voters are slowly realizing that Santorum believes every crazy thing that's coming out of his mouth, which, you know, is pretty much an explicit exoriation of a public figure. Like, is this just like whatever you guys feel like doing, or is there like a, you know, an evaluation of that sort of process that goes on?
No, we don't try to placate. We're so cool, man. I mean, we're just so cool.
It's true.
But it is kind of like Chris was saying at the beginning, like, it's interesting, some articles, conservatives will post it and say, like, see, this is a great satire against liberal weakness. And then liberals will post the same article and say, see, this is a great satire about whatever. I think, you know, people see, they want to see their own beliefs and views reflected in writing, that especially if they find it funny. And, you know, Onion has a certain kind of cachet as being something of a hip brand. So we don't aim to do it, but it winds up happening anyway.
Yeah. All right, cool. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, I think we are out of time. They have a strict deadline here. So thank you, Chris. Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, guys.